Thanks, Lorraine. Good evening. My name's Tom.
Hi, Tom.
And I hope I don't have to get too close to this thing, do I? Yeah, I made the mistake maybe of saying something out loud at the discussion meeting on Thursday, and I got Larry's attention, so here I am. I never really know how to begin. I guess I'll just jump into it and correct myself as I go along. I started drinking about, I guess I was 15. I guess like in the same way a lot of people start drinking. You know, you're in high school and you're exposed to it, and you find a circle of friends, and as soon as you take a drink, you feel a little bit more confident and at ease and part of. I know I talked more freely and kind of found my voice. I felt like I fit in. I had a place. And I was a chatty drunk. As soon as I started drinking, I liked to talk. And I talked and talked and talked. And, you know, nobody told me to go home. And next week they called me back. So I don't know. That was funnier. That was funnier. Sometimes I'm a bit of a downer, I guess, or humorless, maybe. And I liked it. And we did a lot of drugs. First year, anyway. I used to drop acid. I was talking about this the last time I shared. And I really only did that for a few months. But it taught me how to drink. It taught me how to drink. After 3 or 4 months of using that once a week or so, I really didn't need it anymore. I liked to drink, and I was a blackout drinker from the beginning. I liked to show off drinking. I hung around really with a group of people who were a few years older than me. Not a lot. I was 15, they were 17, 18, that kind of thing. And I like to keep up, and I like to, I don't know what, win, I guess. I guess I drank more than a lot of people did. I don't know. What does all that mean? I guess the progression of alcoholism. You know, we drank on weekends. Didn't have a lot of dough. I had a little job washing dishes at a restaurant when I was that age, and so I had a lot of freedom. I worked nights. I came home to, you know, my parents' house at any hour I wanted to. Basically, you know, I mean, once I started working till 2 o'clock in the morning some nights, then that was it. I was free. There really wasn't anybody to tell me, and they didn't really try to. There wasn't really a lot of supervision. I was the last of 8 kids. And I came and went as I pleased, really, you know. I was pretty quiet. I wasn't really a lot of trouble. I didn't get into a lot of trouble. Never got arrested. Not a lot of bad things really happened. And I just stayed under the radar. We all go on a lot about our childhoods and our family lives, and I'm not sure I know what it really has to do with me being an alcoholic. My main responsibility as an alcoholic is not to take the first drink. The strife and the trouble and the conditions of my life that make me unhappy, that will create the kind of unhappiness that a drink will ease, that's the stuff I need to work on. I guess that's why we talk about it. I don't know. I came from really kind of a hellish household. It was, like I say, there was overcrowding, and my father was an alcoholic, in my opinion. He's dead now. Actually, both my parents are dead. He was an alcoholic, in my opinion, and I judged him as an alcoholic when I was a kid. He was a loud, obnoxious kind of drunk, but a binge drinker. Like I say, with the overcrowding, he worked for CN. He didn't make a lot of dough, but he drank probably too much of it. So it was really poverty, and there was other kinds of abuse. You know, I had 6 sisters, and let me just say that they had it worse in the house than I did. And that's colored really my attitudes towards women and all kinds of things in my life. You know, there was a lot of damage, I think. Maybe that sounds too dramatic. And the fact is, none of that makes me an alcoholic. It just creates the conditions in my life that perhaps I want to change with a drink. I really believe alcoholism is a biological disorder. Primary thing about it is, if I take a drink, I develop a craving for another drink. Alcohol just tastes like more to me. Normal people, if I can call other people who aren't alcoholics necessarily normal, don't have that reaction. They have one or two drinks, and it starts to make them a little sleepy or a little dizzy or a little uncomfortable or a little nauseous, and they stop. They have to. They feel a little sick. I don't get that reaction. I get enthused. I get hyper. I start planning how I can get more. I went, and I think about alcohol all the time too. So that, not because I take the first drink, I suppose, each time. I had an obsession with alcohol because I enjoyed it so much, because I enjoyed that reaction that, non-problem drinkers don't get. To them, alcohol is not a stimulant like it was to me. Or at least it was a stimulant in moderate doses, and then it became a depressant as I got to, 15th or the 20th drink. What's my point now? I get lost a lot. I liked drinking. I got a kick out of it. I liked that feeling of ease and comfort that came with the drink. I liked the feeling of confidence that came. The sense of place and belonging and all of those things. All those things that can come to a person's life anyway, you just have to work at them and grow up. So I hear a lot of people say in AA that when they started drinking, they stopped growing, and I think that's true of me. And it's true because alcohol is a shortcut to feeling okay with yourself without actually having to do anything. So I developed something of an obsession with alcohol. Over the years, it increased. There were periods in my life, mostly in work situations, where that increased. I went back to university when I was 23 or so, and my drinking increased because I had more time and more freedom. I started working construction between the first and second year. I took a job in Ontario with my brother-in-law, and I really liked that. We worked like dogs in the hot sun all day, and everybody on the crew was an alcoholic. Half of them had done time for something or other. I was just kind of a skinny sort of guy. I don't know. I was somebody's brother-in-law, and I got a job in the construction site. But they all drank, and we all went drinking every day at 3. And the next thing I knew, I'd wake up, and it would be morning, and we'd do it all over again for about 6 weeks. That was an acceleration of my drinking, and I really didn't back off too much from it. There are places in my life where it just increased and increased. And I like construction. I think, I'm pretty much a lifelong underachiever. I'm looking for somewhere to hide. I don't want to work too hard. I don't want to do too much. I don't want to take on too much responsibility. And construction was a good place for me. I figured I was smarter than everybody I worked around. I could just kind of skate by, make a little dough, drink what was left over, pay the bills. I always tried to meet my expenses and meet my obligations. And I drank pretty much everything that was left over. I did that for years. I did that for years, and I got different jobs for different general contractors, most of whom weren't the most reputable. They were good examples to me of how not to behave. And I drank with them. What can I tell you? It's probably 5 or 6 years of not very much useful going on. When I was about 29, I started getting really bad hangovers, and I didn't like them. I hadn't experienced that before, and I started telling myself things like, I'm not going to do that again. I know I never said to myself, I'm never going to drink again. I think some part of me knew that was ridiculous, but I didn't want that particular effect. We've all had hangovers. I just wasn't used to it. I guess I'd had a free ride for a while, but the day after I was throwing up, and of course you have a headache, and you can't eat anything, you can't keep anything down, you have heartburn for days afterwards. It's really, really nasty. Of course there was a blackout involved in that, and that's pretty much alcohol poisoning, I guess, in retrospect. I'm not going to do that again. And the next week there I was with the same hangover. I'd done the same thing with the same people at the same time. And, and I had judged my old man as an alcoholic, I knew what an alcoholic was, or I thought I did. And standard wasn't a guy with a brown bag in the alley. It was somebody who had a job who just drank, was a binge drinker pretty much on a weekly basis. I drank more than my father ever did. So I started thinking about AA. I didn't start thinking about it. I brought myself to AA. I sent myself as a punishment to AA. AA was the place where I was going to go sit in the corner with my dunce cap because I didn't know how to drink the way I thought I should. That's how I felt about AA. This was a punishment, and I was going to inflict it on myself. And the funny thing is that I walked in, and I liked the people. I thought they were all a little simple-minded about the God stuff. You know, that was just really another shortcut. I had a lot of stuff, a lot of theories, and a lot of ideas about how everything was going to work. But you guys didn't drink, and I liked the group that I went to. And I didn't want to talk about God, and I didn't want to admit it, I was an alcoholic. I really wasn't ready to do that. So it wasn't really a lot I could participate in. But I made coffee at that group for a few months. And I listened to what everybody had to say, and I didn't share very much. And I never read anything up front, and I didn't get a sponsor, and I didn't do the steps. I didn't do anything. The one meeting a week, and I made coffee. And I stayed sober. Just because I became a member of a group of people who didn't drink. It was just that group energy was really enough to just coast on. It cost me nothing. There was no DTs. There was no difficulty. It was as easy as anything. I just stopped because you guys didn't drink, and that's where this is the group I joined. And then I started thinking. And then I started thinking that it seemed a bit drastic to never drink again for the rest of my life. That really seemed a little over the top. I didn't know, why would someone not have a glass of champagne at New Year's Eve, you know, or if your friend got married, to not toast her, you know, congratulations. I mean, you had to have a drink. You couldn't go out on a date and order dinner and not have a glass of wine. I mean, it didn't make any sense. And at that point in my life, I don't know if I'd ever had a kind of formal date where I took someone out and we ordered a bottle of wine. I don't think I've ever done that at that time. Somehow that was a reason that I had to go out and drink again. So I guess, by that, you know, after 4 or 5 months, I knew I was going to drink again because I knew it didn't make, I couldn't imagine not ever drinking. I just did. I made a decision to do it. It wasn't even a slip. I could never call it a slip. I had never embraced the program really at all. So I went out and I drank for another year because I decided to. It's very strange. It's an obsession with alcohol. It's cunning and baffling, and I wanted to drink. So I did. My drinking changed, of course. I learned some stuff about alcoholism. I'd heard about about obsession. You know, I realized that I really didn't have the kind of control over alcohol that I thought I did. In that year, many, many days I said to myself in the morning, I'm not going to drink today. I'm going to have a clean day today. And by 4 o'clock, I'd be drinking. And I, for the life of me, couldn't understand how I could forget something like that. How could I be on my third beer and remember that I wasn't going to drink today? I said, well, tomorrow, you know, tomorrow's another day. I'll try it again tomorrow. And tomorrow I do the same thing. I might have done that 100 times in that year. I'm exaggerating. We all exaggerate. I don't know how many times. I didn't keep track of that. I did keep some track of stuff. I started to write down how much I drank. In the morning, I had a calendar on my back door in the kitchen, and I would write down on yesterday's date, to the best of my recollection, how many drinks I thought I had, whether it was a shooter or a beer or whatever it was. And then I would see it. I would see it at the end of the week. I would see it at the end of the month. It was, you know, hundreds and hundreds of drinks a month, you know. I had tried to quit smoking before and got the patch, and I had to go to a doctor, and the doctor asked me, how much do you drink? And I said, I played it down. I figured if I said 2 or 3 a day, I don't know what number I gave her, you know, 20. So maybe 20 drinks a month. And she said, well, that's a great deal. You should really maybe get your liver tested. And God, if she only knew, you know. If she only knew, I don't even know. I was probably more like 80 or something, you know, on average. I didn't drink. I didn't get stinking drunk every day. There was days when I didn't drink. You know, sometimes it was a 6-pack just to fall asleep. Sometimes it was 17. Sometimes it was 12. Who knew? Sometimes it was 2. the rare occasion I could have the sense to stop if I had something important to do or somewhere to be. So I did that for a year. And one of those nights when I only had two, because I had somewhere to be, was a Thursday. And I had to go see an aluminum siding guy. It doesn't really matter, but I had this appointment to just discuss something about a construction site. And I was meeting him at 7 or something. And I had a couple of beers after work, and I stopped because I had to go out. I had more in the fridge. So I went to do that thing, and I came back. My car is running. I'm on the street. I'm in my car, and there's my stairway up to my apartment. And I can't decide if I should go upstairs and drink the two or three beers that are in the fridge, or if I should go to the Deppener and get 12 more first, or I could go across the street and get a pitcher and a burger, and then I could go to the Depp, and then I could bring it home. But no, I don't want to go to the Depp after I have the pitcher. Maybe I should go to the Depp now. And I was idling. I'm sitting in my car with my car idling for probably a couple of minutes. And the thought came to me, why don't you go to a meeting? Maybe you should go back to a meeting. And the meeting was starting in 10 minutes. And I was in my car and the engine was running. And so I went. And I haven't had a drink since. That was in September 1995. Now what can I say about that? I don't know. I drove over to that meeting and I remember saying to myself, if you're going to go there, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to just do what they do. Do whatever they tell you to do. You know? Stop arguing. I probably heard that phrase, you know, stop fighting. I'm sure I'd heard it in the time that I was there. Scotty used to say here at the Tuesday meeting, surrender, right? So I went to that meeting in my mind, willing to do whatever they said. You know, I don't know in the years since how well I've done that. I'm a contrarian. I'm a skeptic. I'm a critic. There's a lot of stuff I don't like, and if I don't agree with what you're saying, I'm going to examine it and I try to keep an open mind. But until it makes sense to me, I don't believe you. I'm not going to do that. People said 90 meetings in 90 days. I don't think that's reasonable for me. I'll go to as many meetings as I can. And that's what I did. I went to 70 or 80 perhaps. There's been 3-month periods many times in the last, you know, almost 11 years where I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. Just because it suited me. People said, get a sponsor. I got a sponsor. And I learned stuff about sponsorship. I got a sponsor who listened to me complain about my life, which was okay, you know, it was good, it got me through the day. But it wasn't great sponsorship, you know, he was a good guy. He subsequently went out drinking. But I picked somebody who wasn't really going to challenge me, you know, somebody I was comfortable with. I did what I could. I made a lot of changes, you know, don't make any changes in the first year. I changed everything. I started a business, I got into a relationship, I did all kinds of stuff. I figured it's time to live now. That's for people who've been running around in people, places, and things all their life. I've been shy and more reserved, you know, it's time for me to live. It doesn't apply to me. I'm going to do it differently. So I did it differently. It was very difficult. It was painful. After about a year and a half, all of the things that I accumulated, the relationships and the business and stuff, you know, it was flying apart. It was flying away from me. I didn't have any spiritual program. But I never stopped going to meetings. I liked the meetings. I did. That saved me. I liked meetings. I liked the people. I ended up in Ontario at about a year and a half, almost 2 years, trying to hang on to this relationship back here and working there, and it was a mess. It was a mess, and I had no acceptance. I was just struggling. There must be one more thing I can do to fix this. If I can put this here and make that phone call and then try that, and then tomorrow I can... There was no way to fix it. I had to let it all go. I had to let go of everything. I had to stop. I had to learn the second half of the first step. My life is unmanageable. So that was really when I came to grips with the unmanageability of my life, that there was no way I was going to be able to arrange the conditions of my life to create happiness. No one ever can. Happiness just comes from inside. It's only available right now. There's nothing I can do to create it, really, except be still. There's no external condition required. There's no amount of money, no relationship, not anybody else's love, nothing that's going to make me happy if it doesn't come from inside of me. So I didn't learn that at a year and a half. I was hitting bottom, right? I hit emotional bottom. I hit a financial bottom. I hit bottom at a year and a half sober. And I got a sponsor then. And he asked me a couple of questions about the steps and found that I didn't know anything. And he said, well, I'll only be your sponsor if you're going to do the steps. And I went, well, that's what I want. So he did. He did. And he listened to me too, but he didn't. He listened impatiently when I talked nonsense. And we talked about the steps. And he made time for me. He was very generous with his time. And he had 20 years in the program, and he was a big book thumper, and it's what I needed. And I didn't pick him. I took myself out of that. I did. I went to a meeting. Oh, I had a broken arm, too. I was trying to work in Ontario, and I broke my arm. I was really pathetic. I was living in my sister's basement with a broken arm and my poor me, and my car's going to get repossessed, and nobody loves me, and I'm going to eat worms. And I went to a meeting. And they had temporary sponsors at that meeting, and I went to the secretary of the group who had talked about temporary sponsorship, and I said, I wonder if you could pick out a temporary sponsor for me. Just pick. Whoever that is, that's going to be okay. That's the way I played it. Mm-hmm. And I got this guy, Emil. So we did the steps. I did a fourth with him, and I struggled with the fourth. I stared at blank pages for I don't know how long, and I asked him, and asked him, and asked him, and you can't hear it until you hear it. My first practice of the third step was, God, I don't know what to do with this fourth step. I don't know what to do with it. That was the first time I really practiced the third step. I don't know how to do it. I don't understand it. I don't know what I'm supposed to write. I don't know what I'm supposed to write that'll make me feel better. And, you know, the book starts with, you know, we made a list of resentments. And I guess I knew that. I'd read it. I'd been told it. But I thought, I don't hate anybody. What am I going to write about, you know? And a particular resentment of that day came to my mind. So that's it. That's what it is. You know, that little so-and-so said that thing to me about that. That was it. It was simple. And then I thought of another one, and I thought of another one. And I thought about old ones, and I wrote them all down. And it was simple. Once it became simple, it was simple. But you have to stare at it. You have to stare at it as long as it takes to, you know, you have to just keep bringing yourself to it, staring at it, not understanding. Until you understand, you will. Anybody will. So I made an appointment with him to do a fifth, and we went into the rest of the steps. And the 11th step's really been very interesting for me in recent years. Because I'm not particularly religious. I was raised Catholic, and like many people, yada, 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 you know, reject the Catholic Church, all of that stuff. The book says, be quick to see where people of religion are right. And if you have a spiritual practice, adopt that. So I looked into it. I read a lot of books. I read, you know, Christian thought. And Buddhist thought, and Hindu thought, and Taoism, and Zen, and I read all of it. I read lots and lots and lots of it. And because I know the answer is in there. It's in there. But it's in the big book, too. And I knew it was in the big book because I read it when I first came in. It was in the third step prayer. Relieve me of the bondage of self. That's the great truth that all religions are getting at. Relieve me of the bondage of self. You don't have to go to the Himalayas and find a guru. They won't tell you anything more significant than that. For what it's worth, my notion of a higher power is really just that everything is connected to everything. Everything is just temporary. A spiritual experience for me is one alcoholic helping another. If you're new and you come in and you're a little unsteady and I tell you everything's going to be okay, and here's a chair and here's a cup of coffee. That's a spiritual relationship. That's a spiritual experience. It only happens between individuals, I think. There's nothing magical about it. spirituality isn't really spiritual to me. It's more the other way around. It's not magic. It's not hocus pocus. You don't have to believe in any fantastic religious stuff. It's right here. This is our plane of existence. This is where we have a spiritual experience. It's on the phones. Because you treat the other alcoholic or the other person, as the 12-step says, you know, practice these principles in all our affairs. You know, you meet someone else and you treat them as if they were your own self. You forget about the boundary of self and the next person, you know. We make other people suffering our own, and we use their suffering and we use our own suffering at the same time. So the idea about service in AA really just comes right out of the 11-step. You know, the two aren't really all that different. Not that I'm such a wonderful servant of AA. I take on some service tasks. And you know, the best thing about service is how resentful it makes me. I mean that. When I first made coffee, before I even got sober, when those first 4 months I made coffee and people all buggered off out the door, and it's 11 o'clock and I got to get on a bus, nobody offered me a ride home, nobody helped me put the chairs away or clean the coffee pot, I thought, fuckers. Pardon me. So that's service. I wanted to belong. I wanted to participate. I wanted to give back what I could, because I couldn't, you know, at the time I didn't talk about God or anything. But I was resentful about what everybody else was doing or not doing. It was none of my business. You know, we learn. And became a GSR of a group. And I went to those district meetings. And I thought, why did he talk about the same issues year after year, month after month, you know, same stuff. And I was intolerant of them. I don't want to listen to you. You know, resentment. And you get over it. You know, that's not why I'm here. And I do a phone shift. And there's reasons for resentment in that. And you have to just, I came here for a reason. I have to get through this. The resentment becomes a challenge, an obstacle. And when I overcome it, even if all I have to do is just be still, meditate, and empty my mind of the resentment, if I can do that, whatever way I have to get over it, I have to. That's an obstacle to me having a spiritual experience, which is helping another alcoholic, is my own resentment. And it comes up over and over. The more I do, the more I think you should be doing. Well, it doesn't work that way, and I have to keep pushing past that. That's interesting to me. I don't know. I don't know if that's interesting or not. It doesn't really matter. So where am I today? I'm self-employed. I still work in construction. I do small little renovation projects, and I work at my own pace and for people I know, people word of mouth. One person recommends me to another. That's how that works. I just do it on faith. It's been all right for years now, and I'm sure it will be again. You know, I'm not getting rich at it. I try to be of service in the thing that I do. My mother passed away last year. She had Alzheimer's. And I stayed with her for a while. And I did what I could in that situation. We kept her at home as long as we could, you know. We made her meals and we cleaned her up and we did what we could. And some of it was difficult. Things you would not imagine you could ever do. More than once in AA, I've been in a difficult situation, which was more challenging, that is to say, if I had not been in it, I would have imagined I couldn't do it. And yet when you're there, you take the next step, you put one foot in front of another, and you do it. And the more you do things like that, the more confidence you gain, the more you realize, the more faith you gain, you know. You know, all I have to do is take the next step, and it's going to be okay. So we took, you know, I took what steps I could in that. It's probably the only thing in my life where sometimes I get a twinge of regret. I could have gotten more involved at a deeper level earlier in her care. But I did what I could. I did. I know that. I'm confident about that. And so we settled the estate. It was a little bit of dough. And I bought a house. I used it as a down payment. And had I been drinking, you know, I wouldn't have been of use to anybody. And had I been drinking, I don't think that ever would have been stable enough to have used that well, that little bit. I like my little house. I was saying that the last time I spoke. It's comfortable. Like, well, I took a roommate in, you know, I share expenses. He's also a member. And we get along wonderfully. No problems at all. Very, very smooth. I really, to tell you the honest truth, I don't have a problem in the world. I'm not worried about money. I don't have a lot, but I don't worry about it. I'm not really worried about anything. I'm not worried about relationships. I'm not in one, and I don't care particularly. I'm not upset or freaked out by that. Everything is okay. Everything. I don't know what else I have to say. What else do I have to say? Something to the newcomer, if I could think of it. Don't quit. Just keep putting one foot in front of the other. If you're new, don't quit. Go to a lot of meetings. You know? If you don't believe it, don't believe it. Just keep coming to meetings. Believe it when you're ready to believe it. Just don't quit. So with that, I think I'll thank you very much for asking me to speak, Larry. And hope you all have a good 24 hours. And see you next time. Thanks.
Good to hear.
Thank you. For some reason, I believe I was supposed to be at work last night, and